Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
It's August 21st, 2017, and the violence is as bad as we have ever seen it in recent decades. Not since the peak of World War II, where America was so uncertain about whether or not we should even get involved in World War II, never have we seen this level of violence from the far right, from Nazis. It's 2017. When I was recording last year, so 30, 40, 50 episodes ago, and Donald Trump was just a candidate, we weren't entirely sure what he was going to do. I said at that time, just the fact that this guy has a national audience, a national captive audience that just hangs on his every word. Even if he doesn't get the nomination, even if he doesn't become president, his language, his rhetoric, his actions, the people that hear them, the folks that are tuned in to the dog whistle language, I said, those folks are going to be with us for a long time, and those folks are going to do tremendous damage. I had other concerns about Trump as a candidate. First of all, the whole world's watching us and just laughing their arses off. But the biggest thing to me, the biggest thing was the white supremacy issue, the Nazi issue. I hammered on this harder than I've hammered on anything else. And I have been spitting this same game for almost 20 years now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 216. I am broadcasting from beautiful Portland, Oregon, and we are seeing 95% of an eclipse today. I've been busy as of late with weddings and all the rest, but I waited until today to record because I kind of wanted to record during this event. So I watched the eclipse and then I stepped into the studio and I hit the mic. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go.
Gianno, do you agree with that? Will Donald Trump do better than maybe anyone else on the GOP side as far as getting the African-American vote?
Well, first, let me clear up some confusion because there seemed to be some confusion in terms of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not racist. He has black friends. He's in good shape.
Gianno Caldwell belongs to a group called Project 21. It's a think tank out of Washington, D.C. He also has a Republican strategy company called Caldwell Consulting. And Gianno Caldwell is black and a conservative. He belongs to a very, very small, a very small minority, and a black conservative. But that was him during the election saying, hey, Donald Trump is not a racist, right? And this is what we hear. He's not a racist, not a racist. Gianno Caldwell went on Fox News last week and was asked, hey, so that whole not racist thing, where are you at on that now? And I'm not going to play the clip for you because it doesn't translate as well in audio as it does in video. Just go ahead and look it up yourself. The name is G-I-A-N-N-O, Gianno Caldwell. Just punch in Gianno Caldwell, Fox News, into YouTube, and you'll see the video. And it's a little tough to watch. I don't agree with Gianno's politics, but to watch him lose it on live TV, this gentleman began crying because he realized that as a black conservative, he's supported and supporting a white supremacist, a Nazi sympathizer. And I think the country is finally where I have always been on this particular issue. A little bit of backstory. I was in a number of bands for years. The biggest one, probably the most consequential one for me, was one called Two Word Culture. And I'm fairly certain I've told this story before. And Two Word Culture became as such after a good friend of mine realized that I had a knack for translating politics, whenever I, when you know, I he talked with other folks about politics, he talked to me about politics, and he always seemed to like my take. And it wasn't just that we were on the same political side necessarily, but he liked the way that I explained it and said, hey, you should write more about that. You should do more about that. So I ended up, every lyric, every word in the entire, for the entire time I was in the band, all had to deal with politics. And the opening track on the one record that we put out was a song called The Fascist Gun in the West. And I just went through this entire storyline where I described folks, and I wanted to play the song here on the show, but it's metal, it's punk, it's really abrasive music. It's, you kind of have to be into abrasive music. And because I'm so excited, I'm just screaming my guts out the whole time. And if you can imagine me being so excited. So in the song, I tell the story about people tearing each other apart, about the white supremacists in the streets, you know, and then the Antifa. I didn't call them Antifa. I just, you know, called them, you know, the opposition in the streets fighting Nazis. And I described a world that I saw potentially happening. And the reason I saw that was because, and it wasn't that the Republican Party was being explicitly Nazis or explicitly white supremacists or anything like that, but they seemed to have no problem coddling them. And so I said, well, if this continues on its current trajectory, you know, a couple of years, maybe a couple of decades, we could see something like this really come to a head. We could see Nazi sympathizers. We could see a white supremacist Republican Party. We could see a white supremacist president. But then Barack Obama happened. And I said, you know what? Maybe not. We got a black president. Maybe not. You know, maybe I was wrong. And so during the entire Obama presidency, I looked back at those songs that I wrote. And I said, well, it was a moment in time, and that was the way I felt. So I said, I'm not going to take the songs back. I'm not embarrassed about the things that I said. You know, yeah, I suppose I seemed a little bit alarmist. I said, but the songs are still good songs, and fascism always comes back around. These things go in cycles, so many of these things. You know, politics and history, these things go in cycles. During a lot of the Obama presidency, I just kind of looked back at those songs and I went, well, I really thought this could potentially happen. We got a black president now. But I did pay attention to another thing that didn't escape me. And that was the absolute rise of white supremacist hate groups. They doubled and tripled and quadrupled, grew by something like 125% or, I mean, in the first year, it was amazing. Like, the first year, it's like 125% more white supremacist groups. I go, what? And there's more and more and more. And there's like 500% more. And I go, whoa, wait a minute. We just elected a black guy. And I wrote a couple of songs in 2005 about Hurricane Katrina. And I remember watching President Bush at that time ignore Hurricane Katrina. This was another thing that made me think that the Republicans might be a white supremacist party. I remember watching him ignore Katrina. And he gets on the mic and he goes, just do what the local authorities tell you to do. And the local authorities go, hey, feds, we need some stuff for our people. And the Bush administration did nothing. And then they sent Michael Brown down there. And Michael Brown knew nothing about federal emergency management. The guy was the judge of a horse contest or something stupid. And he did a terrible job. And then Bush down there goes, you're going to do doing a heck of a job, Brownie. Remember a heck of a job, Brownie? And when I watched the president ignore just one of the biggest American cities that we have, one just this absolute landmark, this place of history. Everybody knows New Orleans, whether you've been there or not. But here I was, watching an American president just ignore an entire city as they drowned, as they lost their homes, as bodies, this is 2005, bodies, mostly black bodies, floating in the streets of New Orleans. It was an insane time. And I said, how is this president just ignoring that? These are Americans. But then it hit me. I go, they're also black. Is it possible? Could I be so cynical as to think that an American president would ignore an entire city because the victims were black? I ended up penning two songs out of it. One was called Shotgun Houses, and the other was called Nighttime in the Lower Nine. And Nighttime in the Lower Nine was referring to the Lower Ninth Ward, which is largely black. The low-lying areas in New Orleans are largely black. And then, of course, Shotgun Houses, there's a lot of what they refer to as Shotgun Houses in New Orleans. So I said, the point I made in the one song, it hurt me so bad to watch what happened in New Orleans that I didn't write just one. I wrote two songs about that very specific incident. I didn't mention Katrina and I didn't mention, you know, Bush or any of that, but it was pretty clear in the lyrics where I was going. And in Nighttime in the Lower Nine, I suggested that the president ignored that city because it was black, because he's a racist. And in Shotgun Houses, I made a whole nother case that the reason he ignored them is because they're poor. Politics is about money. The Republican Party is about money, making as much money as only a very small handful of people can make. It's not for everybody. It's a very small handful of people. So I go, it's either because they're black or because they're poor that he doesn't care about them. And at that time, Kanye West got in a little bit of trouble because he went on TV and he said, George Bush doesn't care about black people. And I nodded. I wholeheartedly agreed. Because here we were watching an American city drown. And I said, there's no other explanation. Years removed from that, when I really thought about it, I said, maybe it was neither thing. Maybe the entire point of just watching the entire city in peril. Now, the people in the higher up areas, the people that had means, you know, the hills didn't flood. The low-lying areas flooded. The poor people, the black people. The people that had means to get out of town, yeah. The people that, you know, didn't have to hunker down because they had a way out of town, they were fine. But they had money. So when I really thought about it, and I was being a little less cynical, I said maybe the entire point of Hurricane Katrina was so that Bush could make the point the Republicans have been trying to make really just about their entire existence. And that is that government doesn't work. And that line was what really stuck for people. No one saw it the same way I saw it. They didn't see it as racist or he hated poor people. So George Bush ignores New Orleans. He ignores Katrina. And then the line on right-wing radio becomes, see, that's government for you. Government can't do anything right. And I says, now wait a minute. What about Bush? Bush decided not to do anything. And at that point, the line was, yes, he did. Sean Hannity's big thing was, they had all these buses. They could have bussed people out of town. What about the buses? It became a big effing joke whenever we talked about Sean Hannity. What about the buses? Why didn't they just get the buses? But where the hell would you have taken them? That wasn't enough. They needed more, and they asked the feds for more, and the feds ignored them. So they ignore Katrina. And the line becomes, it's because government can't do anything right. Ignoring the fact that it's a Republican president that decided not to respond. And for me, that's where the Republican Party really started looking like not just willfully ignorant or murderous, bloodthirsty, but racist, hardcore racist. And the fact that George W. Bush was willing to coddle racists just to get their votes. The Republican platform doesn't include us as regular working people. It is really only there to serve very wealthy people. After Ronald Reagan got the nomination, He went to Philadelphia, Mississippi to kick off his campaign. What the hell is in Philadelphia, Mississippi? I'm sure you've seen tourist posters all over the place. Come to beautiful Philadelphia, Mississippi, and see where three civil rights workers were murdered during the civil rights struggle. Why the hell did Ronald Reagan go to Philadelphia, Mississippi? This was the dog whistle, and the racists heard it loud and clear. Philadelphia, Mississippi is, if you've ever seen the movie Mississippi Burning, that's where three civil rights workers were murdered, and the case was never solved. And the local police just looked the other way. So Ronald Reagan goes there, and he gives a speech about states' rights. And that was the dog whistle that the racists were looking to hear. But it didn't start with Ronald Reagan. And you go back to the Richard Nixon administration. And there's one of his policy guys that has now given an interview and said, yeah, the whole war on drugs thing, yeah, that was so that we could arrest black people and hippies. Because, you know, black people and hippies were protesting us. And we didn't want to be protested. And we needed an excuse to arrest them. Now, black people don't use drugs at a higher rate than do white people. But, they arrested them before they arrested white people. But they would arrest white people too because, hey, you can't protest our administration. And then we go forward. So we've got Nixon, and then we've got Ronald Reagan. Big fat shout outs to the racists, right? Nixon also used something called the Southern Strategy. And so we move forward to George H.W. Bush. So W's father. George H.W. Bush gives a speech at Bob Jones University, a historically whites-only college. But, of course, to give him credit, he comes out later and he says, hey, Bob Jones University needs to get rid of that policy and own up to what, it doesn't matter. You spoke at the damn university. You got your shout out to the racists in there. And then George W. Bush did the same thing. He gives a speech at Bob Jones University and then just kind of does the same, wash his hands thing. Hey, you need to get rid of that whole whites only thing. But it doesn't matter. He's given his shout out to the racists by speaking at Bob Jones University. And then he begins pushing states' rights. Ah, there's your other dog whistle. You have to speak the language. Then that takes us up to Barack Obama. And the Republicans lose for a while. They come back stronger with the Tea Party. The Tea Party was really just where the Klan really began rising. Oh my God. Black guy in the White House. Gotta go. get the rope. And then here he comes. So I've taken us all the way from Nixon to now. I would say Eisenhower was probably the last legitimately elected Republican president that was not a complete and utter outward racist. Every single Republican president since then has either been a racist or been willing to coddle the racists in order to get the votes that he needs to get into public office. And whether you are a racist or whether you're just coddling racists, it's the exact same thing. And now, here we are, 2017, you know, in a post-racial America. Right after we just had a black president, we now have a Nazi sympathizer as president.
I don't care what he says to the Russian prime, to the Russians. I mean, okay. He's the president of the United States. If he wants to say that, Barack Obama wants to say whatever. If George Bush says, I looked in his
if
eyes
he took
and
a dump
he
on his desk, you would defend it.
Say it.
I mean, I don't know what he would do that you would not defend. I mean, you're
So that's Anderson Cooper talking to Jeffrey Lord. And if you've ever seen Jeffrey Lord on CNN, he's one of those guys that thinks he's being too cute by half by accusing the KKK of being a Democratic group, of being a leftist group. So I've mentioned this before. The parties have changed and changed a lot. Yeah, the Democrats used to be the party of the Klan. They were the Dixiecrats, the white Southern racists. But then Johnson signed the Civil Rights Amendment, and the Klan went to the Republican Party. Here's the thing. If you're looking at, and Republicans like to confuse the history on this intentionally so that they can deny that they're a bunch of racists. And they are. Sorry, you're a bunch of effing racists. If you support Donald Trump, you're a racist. Or you're in denial. That's it. But you're still a racist, even if you're in denial. So Jeffrey Lord loved confusing this issue. He'd say, hey, the KKK is a bunch of Democrats. Well, they're not. But if you're looking at a political spectrum, I myself, regardless of the party's name, am always going to be on the left side of the spectrum. I understand some people get conservative as they get older. I say you're losing your wisdom. You get too damn conservative. But I digress. But if you look at the left side of the spectrum, that's where I'm always going to be. I'm always going to believe in progressive issues. If the Democratic Party once again becomes the party of the Dixiecrats, I'm still going to be way to the left of them. No freaking way. So there are no Nazis. Well, there's not a significant number of Nazis on the left side of the spectrum. You guys have all of those on the right. So, Jeffrey Lord. Jeffrey Lord worked for CNN. Jeffrey Lord would come on TV all the time and defend the hell out of one Donald Trump. About a week and a half ago, he decided, and I don't know why, he probably thought he was being hilarious. Jeffrey Lord decided to tweet out Sieg Heil, the Nazi salute. And he was fired from CNN, which is unfortunate because it's getting harder and harder to find people who are willing to defend one Donald Trump. So we get to Charlottesville. And in Charlottesville, the Nazis felt like it would be out effing standing to get into the streets and start marching for white pride, screaming things like, we will not be replaced by Jews. And David Duke and Richard Spencer and all these guys are so excited because they've got the White House and they've got the Congress and blah, blah, blah. White powers, come to America. Nazis in the street. It's 2017. Why the hell do we have Nazis? Okay. So we all know what happened in Charlottesville. You can't get away from the news. And one white supremacist decided to drive his car into a group of Antifa, a bunch of anti-fascists, and he kills somebody. So Donald Trump comes out and says, both sides are responsible, both the Nazis and the people that are fighting against the Nazis. That's not a direct quote. And then 2 days later, he says, okay. Racism's evil. Let me give you this. So the headline, this is by Matt Shulman at Talking Points Memo. The headline says, white supremacist leader, Spencer, Trump's condemnation isn't serious. White supremacist leader Richard Spencer asserted Monday that President Donald Trump wasn't being serious when he denounced hate groups by name 2 days after blaming many sides for the violence at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The statement today was more kumbaya nonsense, Spencer said at the press conference. You can say racism is evil. We should all love one another. The sun should always shine 7 days a week. Everyone should be above average. Everyone should be a wonderful athlete. Everyone should love each other. It's just silliness, Spencer says. It's not serious, and I don't think anyone takes him seriously, including the president, he added. So Trump says, quote, racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. Reading slowly from his prepared remarks, he sounded like a Sunday school teacher, Spencer said. I don't take him seriously. Then the president was supposed to give a speech at, I think it was Trump Tower. I can't remember which building it was. He was supposed to give a speech in the lobby about infrastructure. And then he starts going off on a tear about the alt-left. And don't the leftists have to own up to any of this? A couple of things. First of all, there's no alt-left. None. There are no left-wing supremacists of any kind. It's a lie. The other thing is, if you're fighting Nazis, you shouldn't have to apologize for that. If you're a Nazi, you should have to apologize for that. So, and then Trump says there's good people on both sides. And here is where the world starts coming apart. On Fox News, there's a clip of a couple of commentators. And it's not what you would expect to hear from Fox News. They both said that is absolutely disgusting. Now, this is Fox News. I mean, this is the home of white supremacists. This is their television news channel. That and InfoWars. And Breitbart. I think Breitbart's got a newscast, too. So these three websites just make up the vast majority of where white supremacists go to get their news. And on white supremacist Fox News, they say, well, okay, so maybe Fox News isn't racist, but they're just number one with racist, as the old saying goes. A couple of the reporters on there are going, that's disgusting. There are no good people on the Nazi side. None. There are no good people. That makes me sick. It was that kind of conversation happening on Fox News, and I go, oh boy, it is now starting to come apart. So the speech that he gave, where he started making his both sides argument again, that was supposedly where Donald Trump just went off the rails, just went off script. He just didn't say what he was supposed to be saying that day, right? He went out there to talk about infrastructure and ended up being a Nazi sympathizer. That's not what was supposed to happen. And they said he was just pulling things out of his butt, top of his head. But then, a very good photographer snapped a couple of pictures of Donald Trump up there at the podium, folding up a piece of paper after he gave his remarks where he was defending white supremacy. And this was supposedly, he just pulled these words off the top of his head. But the reporter gets the picture, and it clearly shows that those remarks defending white supremacists, those remarks by President Donald Trump, those remarks were prepared.
If Trump were black, you would call him a thug. That's what you would call him. Any African-American going around bragging about sexual assault, every African-American would have to come on the air and apologize for the failure of black men.
So the headline from Think Progress by E.A. Crunden, Trump eliminated funding for a group countering white radicalization prior to Charlottesville. Quote, a white supremacist rally in Virginia led to the deaths of three people and dozens of injuries less than 2 months after the White House halted funding for a program aimed at countering white nationalist extremism, despite warnings from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. There's a group called Life After Hate. Okay, remember that name, Life After Hate. And this is a group that helps people get out of white supremacist groups. Founded in 2009, Life After Hate is run by former members of racist extremist movements who now work to counter and reform white nationalists. Under former President Barack Obama, the organization received $400,000 as part of its counter-violence extremism program, the only anti-white nationalist group given funding under the program. After Trump's election, Life After Hate reportedly saw a 20-fold increase in calls for help. These are people trying to get out of the white supremacist lifestyle. Okay, so they saw a 20-fold increase in calls for help from those reporting signs of radicalization in themselves or others. But that uptick seemingly did little to convince the president's administration that Life After Hate's work was valuable. Reuters reported in early February that the government was looking at the shifting the CVE program's focus, honing in on extremism connected to Muslim groups especially. So only the brown people. The administration also froze $10 million in CVE funding. Only a few months later, Life After Hate was dropped from the program's list of funded groups. Quoting here, It's a message that white extremism does not exist or is not a priority in our country, when in fact, it is statistically larger and more present than any threat by any foreign or domestic actors. This is according to the head of Life After Hate, Christian Piccioloni. We have hundreds of thousands of homegrown sovereign citizens and militia members with ties to white nationalism training in paramilitary camps across the U.S. and standing armed in front of mosques to intimidate marginalized Americans. Tragedy in Charlottesville seems to have confirmed Piccioloni's worst fears. Fields, who allegedly killed Heyer with his car, was photographed earlier on Saturday with Vanguard America, whose motto is Blood and Soil, derived from the Nazi slogan Blut und Boden, a nod to racial purity. The group's manifesto argues for an economy that is self-contained and free from the influence of international corporations led by a ruthless group of international Jews, which place profit before the interests of our people or any people. The FBI and Department of Homeland Security in May put out a report that said white supremacists will likely pose a threat of lethal violence over the next year. Entitled White Supremacist Extremist Poses Persist Threat of Lethal Violence, the report concludes that white supremacists were responsible for 49 homicides and 26 attacks from 2000 to 2016. That's more than any other domestic extremist movement. So I want to talk to you about Christian Piccioloni. Piccioloni. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right. The head, the co-founder of the nonprofit peace advocacy organization, Life After Hate. He's also authored a book called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. So I was listening to an interview where he was talking about how he became a white supremacist. And this is interesting because we need to understand how these folks get there. And he talks about growing up in a good middle-class home with two loving parents. And he fell a little bit behind in school sometimes. And he mentioned, he said, my parents, their response was to beat the good grades into me. His words. He said, they decided to beat the good grades into me. So he suffered violence at the hands of his parents, who thought they were doing the right thing because they wanted him to get better grades. And I've heard no shortage of people make the argument that the reason that they're doing so well, the reason they're so well adjusted, the reason they're such a great and responsible adult is because they got the piss kicked out of them as a kid by their parents because their parents loved them so much. It's insane. It's identifying with your captor. It's identifying with your abuser. And so there's an article here from Start. This, according to the National Consortium for Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, start.umd.edu, New START research explains how non-ideological factors such as childhood trauma or high-risk behaviors can influence an individual's involvement in violent extremism. The study, led by START researcher Pete Simi, discovered that a large portion of violent extremists interviewed had similar factors in self-reported background stories such as child maltreatment, mental health issues, and alcohol and illegal drug use to a greater extent than the general population. Through extensive life history interviews and 44 former members of violent white supremacist groups, the research found 45% of those interviewed reported being the victim of childhood physical abuse, while 21% reported being the victim of childhood sexual abuse. 57% of interviewees reported experiencing mental problems as diagnosed by a medical practitioner, either preceding or during their extremist involvement. 72% of interviewees reporting having problems with drugs or illicit drugs or alcohol. The study's findings highlight the importance of examining non-ideological factors that can influence an individual to join an extremist movement as he or she may be attracted to its social cohesiveness after having a life of family dysfunction and instability. So, as I'm listening to Christian talk, he mentions the violence that erupted at home. And then he says, and I think he was probably around 10 or 11, somewhere in that neighborhood, and he said that he walked in on his dad with another woman that was not his mom. So he starts in what is seemingly a loving home. He falls a little behind he begins getting abused. And then he sees his dad cheat on his mom. And his world starts to come apart. And he starts detaching from his family. And he doesn't look up to them like he once did. And he said he went from listening to things like Led Zeppelin and Queen to listening to tons of punk rock. If you listen to punk rock, and I spent years in the punk rock community. I started the show talking about being in that community, you know, being a leftist in that community and sort of screaming against what all the hardcore righties in that community are saying. You know, I was a left-wing vocalist writing about progressive issues. But if you're in that community, eventually you're going to run into Nazis. I used to see Nazis at shows all the time, no matter what the show was, if it was abrasive music. I remember seeing at a Pantera concert. It was the first time that I thought the guys in Pantera might be racist, because, of course, the fact that Dimebag had Confederate flags on some of his guitars, that didn't clue me in. But being in the audience and seeing white nationalists, right, they're all gathered before the show, and they're standing down in the pit. And if you've never been to a metal concert, there's a big thing up at the front called a mosh pit. And this is where guys just kind of run in a circle and beat the hell out of each other. It's a very macho thing to do. And I did it for years. You know, it's also very exciting. The way I talk about it and the way they talk about it is obviously very different. But I was sitting behind these guys before the show. So it's a concrete floor, and we're inside this concert hall. And these guys in front of me who are clearly white supremacists. And I hear one say to the other, when this show starts, right, and we get up and we start the mosh pit, I'ma hit that nigger and that nigger and that nigger and that Mexican. And they were very open about it. And I wasn't the only person within earshot that heard that. But no one else around me seemed to respond. And of course, I didn't respond. I'm outnumbered. I'm clearly outnumbered. And I don't want to get my ass kicked by white supremacists. So I quietly get up and move to another spot. Because I don't want to be here when these guys start taking out their aggression in what is really a legal way for them to do so. So Christian Piccolini, he mentions that he starts going to these punk shows. Starts listening to this abrasive music. Then he encounters some white supremacists. And these guys welcome him in. But of course, to stay in and to really be in with these folks, you got to do some things for us. You got to do some violent things. And you got to do some violent things against Jews or blacks or women or something of that nature. He wouldn't go into the story about what it was he had to do to get in really good with the white supremacist groups. He said, but I did some very bad things that I'm not proud of. And so he's in the white supremacist groups. And after spending a number of years in those groups doing terrible, terrible things, he starts having some doubts about the lifestyle, about the choices, about the thoughts that he has as a white supremacist. And he's just sort of looking around and he goes, well, what am I going to do? And so he sees a psychiatrist. And he says, there's two things. He says there's two things that help him get out of the white supremacist lifestyle. This is Christian Piccolini, the co-founder of Life After Hate, which helps people who want to get out of the white supremacist lifestyle. He said there were two things that helped him get out of white supremacy, because obviously the group didn't exist yet. He said, first of all, he had a kid. And that kid was a daughter. He had a baby daughter. And he said, and the effect of something so small and so beautiful, and a woman, right? He says, the way they add femininity to your life, it softens you, no matter who you are. Having this delicate little girl that you're responsible for, he goes, that'll soften you. You know, and he goes, of course, they're born without any of those prejudices. And then there was the other thing. He started seeing a psychiatrist, and he was going pretty regularly. And he was talking with the guy about being a white supremacist and all the horrible white supremacy things that he had did. And after half a dozen visits or so, the psychiatrist says to him, I feel like I can tell you this, Christian, because you're being so open with me. And he says, then I would like to be open with you. And Christian was pretty tight with his psychiatrist by this time. And so the psychiatrist says, I'm Jewish. Not knowing how Christian was going to respond, he says, I'm Jewish. And then that's when it hit for Christian Picciolini. Because he said, here's this guy who cares so much for me and is talking with me and helping me and doing all of these things to help me get better, to help me live a better life, to help me get myself back to where I was before I started joining hate groups. Here's this guy who cares so much about me. And this is somebody that in other years he would have beaten the hell out of just because the guy was Jewish. And he said that's where white supremacy started falling apart for him. The reason that the Trump administration ended, well, obviously, I mean, they ended the CVS funding, you know, which would have gone to Life After Hate to help people get out of these white supremacist groups. Of course, there's a couple of reasons. One of them is the president's a white supremacist and a Nazi sympathizer. But the other thing, Sebastian Gorka, who's very visible, who works for the president, works in the White House, and he's very visible. But the person that really made it happen with respect to cutting off the funding for Life After Hate is Sebastian Gorka's wife, Catherine Gorka. She was the instrument that really made it possible, that really helped with getting the money stripped away from Life After Hate. And then her and her husband, who are a couple of Islamophobes, started putting all the money into fighting brown people. Because really, only brown people can commit terror. So here's where we're at now. There's a lot of people speaking out against white supremacy. They're mostly Democrats. And there are some Republicans speaking out against white supremacy, but they're not specifically going after Trump himself. As a matter of fact, they're being quite complicit. They'll say Nazism is bad, you know, Hitler was a terrible human being, but they won't point out the president's support for it or specifically condemn him. And people are slow to respond if they think that something is going to hamper their own objectives. And that's what's happening here. This is a pretty solid case for the Republicans of party over country.
First of all, I feel like I have certain responsibilities as not just Congressman Paul Ryan from the 1st District of Wisconsin, but as Speaker of the House. And imagine the Speaker of the House not supporting the duly elected nominee of our party, therefore creating a chasm in our party to split us in half, which basically helps deny us the White House and strong majorities in Congress. The last thing I want to see happen is another Democrat in the White House. I don't want to see Hillary Clinton as president. I want to see a strong majority in the House and the Senate. And I think the way to achieve those goals is to have a more unified party than a disunified party. Now, having said that, you know me well, Chuck. If something is done and said that I don't agree with, that I think puts a bad label on conservatism, then I'm going to speak out on it, as I have, as I will continue to do, and I hope I don't have to keep doing.
You just made a case, though, of party over country.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. No, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what you did. You just made the case for party over country. And so I'm hearing this a lot now whenever I turn on the Sunday news shows. And it happened just yesterday with Meet the Press. They were talking about the president's support for white supremacists in the recent week. And Chuck Todd said, we tried and tried and tried. And we were unable to get anybody to come on to support Donald Trump, to defend Donald Trump. So the entire episode of Meet the Press, for once, was either people that were condemning Trump and have always condemned Trump, or who are now condemning Trump for his white supremacist views.
And a minority leader, Chuck Schumer, calling out Republicans for staying silent about Russia meddling in the U.S. election and the need for a special prosecutor.
The silence of my Republican colleagues is choosing party over country at a time when we can ill afford it. It's one of the things the founding fathers most warned about. So our Republicans should be stepping up to the plate and joining us in asking for a special prosecutor. Where is the Howard Baker of 2017?
Senator Schumer there referring, of course, to the Republican senator who famously asked during the Watergate scandal, what did the president know and when did he know it?
All right, let's bring back our panel. We got David Gregory, A.B. Stoddard, and David Drucker. And look, it's worthy of note. You know, we've tried to get Schumer on the show a lot also. But on the Republican side, we invited all of the Republican leadership. Do you hear me? All of it, right? We tried to get dozens of different Republican lawmakers to come on the show. And often we are chock full. But not right now. We went over this weekend, all right?
And that's what I'm hearing over and over again. They can't get any Republicans to come on to defend President Grand Wizard, white supremacist Donald J. Trump. And we should have known this because we got all of the signs. There were the robocalls.
The National Super PAC makes this call to support Donald Trump. My name is Mary Mitchell, and I am a member of the American Freedom Party. I am voting for Donald Trump because he will not only be presidential, he will put America first. Furthermore, he will respect all women and will help preserve Western civilization. If you vote for Donald Trump, he will be a fine president. He will select the very best person to be in his cabinet, and the entire world will benefit from his leadership. This message is paid for by William Johnson, a farmer and a white nationalist.
A farmer and a white nationalist. The warnings were everywhere. We saw them in the campaign ads.
The reason a lot of Klan members like Donald Trump is because a lot of what he believes, we believe in. Donald Trump would be best for the job.
For president.
Yeah.
I am a farmer and white nationalist. Support Donald Trump.
Sending out all the illegals, building a wall, and a moratorium on Islamic immigration. That's very appealing to a lot of ordinary white people.
Running against Donald Trump at this point is really treason to your heritage.
Will you unequivocally condemn David Duke and say that you don't want his vote or that of other white supremacists?
I don't know anything about white supremacists, so I don't know.
Trump named Steve Bannon as his new campaign CEO. Mr. Bannon is best known for his controversial Breitbart News, a campaign chair that ran a website that has become a field day for the alt-right, which is racist and all sorts of other ists.
The alt-right, which is a sort of dressed up in suits version of the neo-Nazi and white supremacist movements.
A lot of what he believes, we believe in.
Yeah, and then that's when the alt-right, that phrase, was introduced into our lexicon. This thing that had been quietly bubbling for years. This thing that I and a lot of other people saw coming up, coming to a head with this white supremacist president. But they couldn't call it white supremacy, at least not right away. They had to call it the alt-right.
Well, essentially, Tamron, the alt-right consider themselves an alternative to traditional conservatism, which they think is weak tea. Their basic belief is that white Americans need to protect themselves against multiculturalism and immigration, which they believe are essentially watering down American culture and putting white people at a disadvantage. It's interesting that the term bigot was actually written into Donald Trump's speech. It wasn't an ad lib. And that is actually a signal from the alt-right because they do believe that the real quote-unquote racism is racism against white Americans. So they're mostly young. They're very tech savvy. They've been connected to things like Gamergate, going after women, going after people of color. What you're seeing happen to Leslie Jones, that's a prime example.
So what's the difference in, I guess, the alt-right and I guess, white nationalists, white supremacists, KKK? Are these all the same people just with a different name here?
Well, just as David Duke took the KKK and dressed it up in a suit and tie, the alt-right is also white nationalism, but they differentiate themselves females in their own minds, saying, well, they are pro-white, and that they claim that that is not racism. So they are basically the next generation of what are traditionally the neo-Nazi movements, the KKK. They essentially are saying that they are a pro-white movement that wants to make America more masculine. They feel America has become too feminized. They're against interventions in foreign wars, and they peg neoconservatism as sort of a Jewish intervention in conservatism. So they're essentially, they are the same thing.
There was no shortage of incidents in American schools where brown people were being harassed. Signs were being put up, things were being said, stuff was being written on walls, horrible racist things because, hey, this is the way the incoming president talks.
Reading High School is making headlines today after a student handed out fake deportation notices to minority students and uploaded video of it all on social media. Action News Now reporter Mario Montalvo visited Shasta High School where it happened. He's live with details and reaction. Mario.
Lauren, officials say the student claims the incident was a joke, but some people in the community aren't laughing. Administrators say the student posted a video which has since been deleted to social media showing himself handing out fake deportation notices to students of color.
It was just a joke. He handed out papers. He asked the people before to film them, and he was joking.
Shasta County Citizens Advocating Respect board member and retired ESL teacher Trent Copeland says this type of behavior stems from the rhetoric that was tossed around during the election.
It's like it's okay. They've heard the president of the United States say it, they hear it at home, and it's going to spill over into the schools.
He says this reminds him of a similar incident where students chanted derogatory slurs at a visiting basketball team. He says the students involved in that case were dealt with quickly and accordingly.
It's not tolerated in the schools. They stop it immediately. And they try to present a diverse curriculum, but we're not a diverse area.
Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition board member Teresa Rivera says they've seen an increased fear of deportation this election year, and what happened at the school was not funny.
We kind of want to make a statement that it's not okay and that students shouldn't have to fear going to school and getting letters of deportation. I think there's other things that they should be worrying about while they're at school.
It's okay. It's all a joke. I'll be honest. I don't understand right-wing humor. And I don't think it's funny. I don't think deportation notices are ha-ha funny. Especially when the president's really talking about sending out deportation notices. And then came the defense. Listen, the defense of racists in this interview. You'll actually hear somebody say, hey, you're being bigoted against racists.
I don't consider a bigot just to have to do with race. Bigotry, if you look at the definition, is about someone that's small-minded and sits there and directs hate towards a certain group. Hillary Clinton's speech was all about hate towards a group that, while my fellow counterpart might consider them to be very racist, it's the exact opposite. These are God-fearing, baby-loving, gun-toting, military-supporting, school choice advocating Americans who love this country. And just because maybe there might be some a part of a small fringe group that read Breitbart, by sitting there and saying that the entire website is white supremacy, it's kind of as ridiculous as saying that just because you have people that are anarchists and communists that read the Huffington Post, calling that newspaper establishment, saying that they're pro-anarchy and they're against the United States government.
They were all clearly and openly racist. But remember, it's still not necessarily okay to be that way. So one, Donald Trump just kept reminding him, just letting him know, hey, I know you're not racist. Everyone else knows you're not racist. You guys don't have to worry about it. We're not really racists.
The news reports are that Hillary Clinton is going to try and accuse this campaign and all of you and the millions of decent Americans who support this campaign, your campaign, of being racists, which we're not.
There has been no shortage of car attacks by ISIS. It's the easiest, fastest way for them to kill people now. They just take a car and they drive it into a crowd of people. That's terrorism. And that's exactly what this guy did when he drove into that crowd of protesters and killed Heather Heyer and injured about 19 other people. And that ISIS-style terrorism tactic being used by ISIS and the white supremacists, The Republican Party, and I'm not joking about this, the Republican Party would like to make those kinds of attacks legal, just as long as they're carried out by white supremacists. In the aftermath, quoting here from The Intercept by Lee Fong, in the aftermath of the murder of activist Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, Virginia, state legislators who had previously pushed the shield drivers who killed protesters with a moving vehicle are largely standing behind their various efforts, arguing that their legislation would not have applied in this weekend's attack. Boo. Before the killing on Saturday, a swath of bills that had been proposed around the country, largely in the South and primarily in response to Black Lives Matter and Dakota Access Pipeline-related protests, the bills largely targeted leftist demonstrators who have increasingly shut down traffic by blocking roads and highways to bring attention to their cause. Under the proposed laws, motorists who struck and killed protesters would have special immunity in certain circumstances as long as it wasn't proven that they acted deliberately. Heyer was struck by a car allegedly driven by James Alex Fields Jr., a white supremacist who is a supporter of Donald Trump. None of the proposed motorist immunity bills debated in half a dozen states are backed by far-right personalities and law enforcement interests that have been made into law. Rather than backing away from the policy in light of these events in Charlottesville, legislators are now doubling down. In Texas, state Representative Pat Fallon introduced a bill to limit the liability of motorists responsible for hitting individuals who are blocking traffic in a public right-of-way while participating in a protest or a demonstration. The Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas, a statewide coalition of municipal and county police associations, lists Fallon's bill among legislation supported by CLEAT. CLEAT are the spikes at the bottom of athletic shoes. In response to criticism over the weekend, Fallon doubled down on social media, implying that his critics don't know the difference between legal and illegal protest. Let me tell you the difference. Legal is when it's white supremacists. Illegal is when it's not white supremacists. North Carolina's version of the bill, HB 330, passed the lower chamber of the legislature in April. The text of the bill says a person driving an automobile who is exercising due care and injures another person who is participating in a protest or demonstration and is blocking traffic in a public right-of-way is immune from civil liability for the injury. The definition of due care, of course, is highly debatable.
To be white is to be a striver, a crusader, an explorer, and a conqueror. We build, we produce, we go upward. And we recognize the central lie of American race relations. We don't exploit other groups. We don't gain anything from their presence. They need us and not the other way around. 2 weeks ago, I might have said the election of Donald Trump would actually lessen the pressure on white Americans. But today it is clear his election is only intensifying the storm of hatred and hysteria being directed against us. As Europeans, we are uniquely at the center of history. We are, as Hegel recognized, the embodiment of world history itself. No one will honor us for losing gracefully. No one mourns the great crimes committed against us. For us, it is conquer or die. This is a unique burden for the white man, that our fate is entirely in our hands. And it is appropriate because within us, within the very blood in our veins as children of the sun, lies the potential for greatness. That is the great struggle we are called to. We were meant to overcome all of it, because that is natural and normal for us. Because for us as Europeans, it is only normal again when we are great again.
Every single clip that I used in today's show was cut well over a year ago. I have used every single clip that I played in today's show in past shows. None of this is new. This has been going on and been going on for a long time. And I have been sounding this bell and marching against these folks for longer than any of you know. And this is how we will be judged at this moment in history. Do not think that you can sit by in your living rooms with your six-pack and your Game of Thrones and your tablet where you're playing Candy Crush or whatever dumb thing you're doing. Don't think that you can sit by and play the role of good German while this is going on and say, hey, I had nothing to do with it. If you are not in the streets, if you are not marching against the white supremacists, if you are not speaking against the white supremacists, then you are complicit. Silence is consent. And this is how history will judge all of us who are alive during this time. Your kids, your grandkids, and their grandkids will say, hey, where were you? What was your response when white supremacists were marching in the streets and we had a Nazi sympathizer as a president? Where were you? What did you do, dad, granddad? What did you do? Well, there was something good on TV. I was really into this thing I was watching. Boy, my sports team was just doing fabulous that year. I remember that year. It was a good year because my team went all the way to the playoffs that year. Yeah, that's what I remember from that time while people were being murdered and beaten and white supremacists' laws protecting white supremacists were being written into our law books so that they can harass black people and Jews and women and anyone else they want. Yeah, I didn't do anything during that time. As I mentioned last week, we all say it. Had I been there at that point in history, I would have done blah. This is that point in history. And I ask you again, and I'll likely ask you every week until we've eliminated these white supremacists or sent them back into hiding. What are you doing at this moment in time? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available. Just search for the Fire You Can't Put Out at the iTunes Store or at Podbean. There you can subscribe so you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep a growing dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. We are the Fire You Can't Put Out. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.